Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
Now, food security, basically the ability to feed ourselves, is a much discussed issue. But less discussed is how the variety of what we consume has dramatically shrunk over time. There was a time when humans ate about 6,000 species of plant. Now it's about 9. Not 9,000, just 9. Dan Saladino is the author of Eating to Extinction, The World's Rarest Foods, and When We Need to Save Them. Dan joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon, Sean.
If you were to compare our average diet now with a few hundred or even a few thousand years ago, did it used to be much more varied than it is now?
Oh, most definitely. If you think that 6,000 plant species have been domesticated by humans over time, we now focus mostly just on 9. And of those, 3, wheat, rice and corn, provide humans with more than 50% of their calories. So the argument I'm trying to make in the book is that for thousands, if not millions of years, humans evolved with huge diversity in their diets. It's only in the last 50, 60 years that we have continued to shrink that diversity down. Now, we did that for good reasons, to produce a lot of abundant calories to feed the world, particularly after the Second World War. But we're realizing it's coming at a very high price now, both for the planet and also for our health. And also the question of what does it mean to be human? Because we all live in a different part of the world, in our own particular environments and ecosystems, with hopefully different cultures and identities, and food is a reflection of that. But it's disappearing as the world has become more homogenized in the way it grows food and eats.
So we're all starting to eat the same thing. I suppose that's the price we're paying, or part of the price we're paying.
Yes, and as you know, obviously, we are a far more joined up planet. I mean, food has been traded and moved around the world for centuries. Because of consolidation, particularly of some extremely powerful and successful companies, it means that we can not only buy the same foods and watch the same films, but we can all start to eat the same types of food and drink the same kind of drink. So I make a point about consolidation, which is that if you think about seeds, so you know the very foundations really of global food production, from all the cereal crops and all the other vegetables we eat, 4 corporations control most of the world's seeds now.
Wow.
One in four beers is brewed by one company. Half the world's cheeses are made with the starter cultures, so that's the kind of the bacterial starter, all the enzymes produced in one lab by one company. So there's been a huge amount of consolidation, which again is great for efficiency, but it's meant that diversity is disappearing. And you know, COP26, for example, is just a few weeks away. One of the issues it's going to be talking about is nature and biodiversity. We think about endangered animals or endangered plant species. Our food is also becoming endangered, and that really matters.
Because I assume as well that even, you know, it's been whittled back to, you know, rice, the likes of rice and wheat, but probably even the varieties of those it just one variety now that's the easiest one to grow?
Absolutely, Sean. And I think what most of us do not realise is that behind some of the world's most important foods, and you mentioned rice, for example, there is a huge amount of diversity. And that's not just in terms of, you know, a particular type, you know, whether it's a long grain or a basmati type. In Svalbard, which is the seed vault for the world, which is a tunnel deep inside the Arctic Circle, they store 1 million seeds. Now, from the million seeds, there are samples of rice there, 170,000 individual samples of rice, 39,000 samples of maize or corn, 21,000 samples of potato, 35,000 samples of millet, and more than 200,000 different samples of wheat. So all of those seeds and all of those crops are locally adapted. So it meant that where you're talking to me from now, there would have been a huge array of locally adapted crops that would have been suitable for the soil, for the climate, even the altitude, and likewise where I'm talking to you from as well. But because in the second half of the 20th century, because we had developed farming based around science and fossil fuels, it meant that we could override nature and that local adaptation and grow the same plants everywhere. But obviously now, you know, we know what the problems are with fossil fuels and with using huge amounts of water for irrigation. And the value of those locally adapted crops that we now have almost lost, we're seeing their importance in a future where we need to shift away from these chemical inputs and this high energy system that produces a lot of calories but comes at a huge cost.
That process that you've just described there, obviously it's been speeding up in this century and in during the 20th century. But if we go back to when we stopped being hunter-gatherers and became farmers, was that the start of this process anyway? Because I assume even then it reduced the amount of variety.
Absolutely. I mean, you could say that was one of the first big bottlenecks, is when we stopped being hunter-gatherers and we became the first, you know, that our ancestors became the first agriculturalists. The Hadza in East Africa, for example, who are some of the last remaining hunter-gatherers who practice no form of farming. There are 1,000 members of the tribe still, but only 200 practice hunting and gathering. Their potential menu in that part of Africa, near Lake Eyasi in Tanzania, is 800 different plant and animal species. When they dig up human remains from bogs and they've been able to look inside the stomachs of those remains, they found enormous diversity of seeds, so 40 different types of seeds in one discovered in Denmark that was around 4,000 years old. Now, clearly, you know, agriculture led to the great first civilizations and cities and populations increased. But what we've done in the last century is really accelerate that process and spread it around the world. So I think, you know, there is a point at which, you know, we are shrinking our legacy, or the legacy that we, or the inheritance from our ancestors, really, of creating huge amounts of diversity.
Yeah. There, just to stay with the Hadza for a second, there's an extraordinary thing they do with a bird, as I understand it, where they have a relationship with these birds.
Absolutely. And I've focused so far in our conversation around the importance of genetic diversity. So all these different plants and animals that we are losing in terms of breeds and different crops. But also I'm trying to tell the story of these disappearing skills and knowledge that humans have acquired over millennia. And in the case of the Hadza, we don't know how far back this goes. It probably goes back to the beginnings of the way when humans started to be able to use fire and smoke. What they do is they go out into the savannah and their favorite food, I mean, anthropologists have carried out survey after survey, their favorite food by far is honey. It's high energy, and because it contains bee larvae and bits of bees as well, it's high protein. But it could take them a long time to go from tree to tree to find the bees' nests. What's happened is this coevolution between man and bird. So they whistle. And a bird, this is the honey guide, scientific name indicator, swoops down and then leads the hunters to the trees where the honey is. The hunters go and get the honey, smoke the bees, and then they leave behind, after they've gorged on honey, a bit of wax for the birds to consume. And the birds otherwise would be at great risk of being stung to death by the bees. So this coevolution, going back hundreds of thousands of years, in our lifetimes could disappear, because I actually spent some time with the Hadza. And while I was there, I went into an area where they hunt. But close by was a little hut with one light bulb hanging down from a wire. But inside this hut, from, you know, wall to wall, was fizzy soft drinks from the West, and also biscuits and cookies. And so the argument being that why would you climb up a tree when you can get a sugar, you know, an abundance of sugar from this place? So in our lifetime, something that has taken humans hundreds of thousands of years to develop, that relationship with the bird, could disappear. And that's a tragedy, really, in terms of the human story.
Yeah. What is the arc of taste?
Well, the arc of taste is how I made sense of this idea of endangered foods. It was set up in the 1990s by the International Slow Food Organization based in the north of Italy. And they realized that in the town, in a town in Piedmont where they were based, that there was certain things that the chefs could no longer buy because the farmers were giving up and no longer buying the or growing these vegetables. And so what they did is they thought that they could try and make a campaign to get local support for these foods and, you know, give the farmers some incentive to grow them. So they created a catalogue of endangered foods so that people knew they existed and they were at risk. This has grown in the last 20 or so years to a list of 5,500 foods in 130 countries. And it's, you know, you name the country, and I'm sure there are some foods, endangered foods, on the Arc of Taste, including foods from Ireland.
Such as?
Well, there are apple varieties. There are, importantly, I think, in terms of Ireland, lots of native breeds or breeds of animals that are adapted to the conditions. So there's the Kerry cow, the Galway sheep, the Irish moyled cattle. These historically were revered, really important animals that farmers had selected generation after generation because they thrived in the conditions of a particular part of Ireland and gave amazing, you know, quality meat and dairy as well. But because animals have gone the same way as crops, that we've discovered, you know, highly efficient breeds, we've focused on them, and then we've sent them all the way around the world so that, you know, most milk around the world is produced by the one breed of cattle, the Holstein. Whereas, you know, we now know that, you know, when it comes to disease risk, for example, in livestock, or, you know, pest resistance and all kinds of other traits that we'll need for the future, diversity and avoiding uniformity is a really good, sensible strategy to have.
The book is called Eating to Extinction, The World's Rarest Foods and Why We Need to Save Them. Dan Saladino is the author. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.